Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the wait is over. Scooter regulations are here, though changes may soon follow. Proposals on how to use the $50 million in bonds for affordable housing quickly use up the money, but now the corporate community is pledging an additional $70 million. More turmoil at UNC Chapel Hill. Chancellor Carol Folt is out, but then so is the pedestal for Silent Sam. Charlotte hosts a 10th anniversary celebration of life for the 155 passengers and crew of U.S. Airways Flight 1549, which crash-landed safely in the Hudson River in 2009, and the investigation into North Carolina's 9th Congressional District continues. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those stories and others, and those reporters include David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning. Welcome.
Hello,
back.
Mike.
Mary C. Curtis is here, columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB-TV.
Good morning.
Good morning. Joe Bruno returns. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV, Channel 9, Eyewitness News.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Eric Spanberg is back. He's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Wait, who's managing the editing right now?
Things get better when I'm away.
Get back because a participle might get misplaced. You never know. All right. Before the new year, the city council was going to wait for the state to regulate scooters. Then they decided, maybe not this week, they approve new rules, but only after a long debate.
We got to move on. I mean, we've got so many other topics that are literally dumpster fires right now, and we're just spending so much time not doing anything on this.
That's City Councilman Tariq Bakari expressing a little frustration.
Yes, dumpster fires, it's subtle.
At a suggestion to put off a final decision. Well, discussion continued, and eventually the council decided on some rules for scooters. Tell us what they are.
Tell us what we've won, David.
So they're pretty basic. There's not a whole lot here, but they do limit the scooter speeds to 15 miles an hour, which is about what they go right now. But the question there is whether new technology might make them go faster in the future, and what happens when you're on a road where the speed limit is higher. Another thing that's really important about this is complaints about scooters downtown. They've limited the area downtown where you can ride scooters on the sidewalk. For the main area of downtown, you got to ride it on the road. And I just saw a couple people out here this morning riding it on the road. So I think that's another important piece here. There's also stuff in what they passed the other night that would allow the city to charge a fee for the scooters. Charlotte's the only city that has scooters in North Carolina right now that doesn't charge a fee, and it could be anywhere from $5 or $10 per scooter to $300 is what they're charging in Raleigh. So.
Isn't it also one person per scooter?
One person per scooter. That's something that doesn't sit well with at least one of the city council members, who I've seen riding with two on there, and I'm not going to name that person.
Oh, got to be
interesting.
Got to be Braxton.
Oh, one of the interesting things was what is not included in this law, because they were talking about some other changes, but they didn't end up including them when they passed them. One is requiring scooters to be on streets that are 35 miles per hour or below. They did not include that. There were some concerns about maybe if that would penalize cyclists in the future, but I know a lot of city council members were not happy that staff took that provision out. And the other one is they were going to require scooters to be scattered in low-income neighborhoods. They took that out and they changed the language and said, we want them placed near transit stops.
So they have put restrictions on riding on sidewalks in a certain area of uptown, and it's bordered, I think, by this street outside our window. 7th Street, is it College and Church? And then Stonewall, is that the area?
Yes, that sounds right.
And, of course, I hope everyone made note of the egregious violation the next day. Julie Eiselt, who is the co-chair of the Transportation Committee, I think it was Tariq Bakari took the picture. Andrew Dunn from Longleaf Politics ascertained that she was, in fact, violating the sidewalk policy, and I think she has owned up to that. So
citizen's arrest.
We have to be very careful. We have a new scooter policy.
Yes, someone is always watching.
That's right.
Yeah. So on your Twitter feed, Joe, you had a question from someone asking if any of these streets have bike lanes, these streets that are where you have to ride in the street, have bike lanes, do they?
I don't believe they do. I believe that you'll have to be out in the street with these scooters, which of course poses a safety risk right there. But I know that the city council is trying to get bike lanes through different parts of Uptown, but I believe this section, I think you're right, Joe.
I think to me, and I ride scooters occasionally, it's a bit of a disincentive to ride them in the close-in downtown part. You know, you get off the train here and maybe just walk a block and get a scooter and ride it where you're going.
Now, do you ride alone or do you typically double up on your scooter?
My family is with me usually.
Oh, very good, very good. Yeah. Mike, I wanted to mention, you know, there is this option, I guess David mentioned it, to charge fees, and it's, I think, between $50 and $300 in other North Carolina cities. But there was debate the week before about the city was intending or looking at using a third-party company to help with imposing the fees. Luana Mayfield was very vocal about asking for more information in terms of why are we looking at doing this, and it just seems to be very muddled, let's say that, in terms of how the dynamic pricing and how the fee will be imposed. So that's something to keep an eye on.
So much about this is all about how will it work. I mean, this is still so new that, you know, it's still evolving, and the cities are talking to one another about what are you doing, and trying to figure out what the best practices
are. And the city of Columbia decided to outlaw them. They're not going to welcome them.
They put a 1-year moratorium on allowing
these. Didn't council member Braxton Winston say that the speed restriction was actually more dangerous?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so did. There was another council member who believes that to be true as well. So let's go back to that. We talked about this in the past, but just for people who weren't listening, what provoked the need for these regulations? I know there are 100,000 riders of scooters in the last year, and they're
per month, 100,000 rides,
and they're like what, 300 or 400? I've forgotten.
There are 900 on the. There are 900 scooters now.
But have they caused a problem? Have there been accidents with riders, with pedestrians, with cars?
Yes. So I remember. I think it was Tark Bakari had the sort of citizens video of someone who was hit while riding a scooter uptown. The person survived, but they were injured. And there have been all these anecdotal stories about people being, sort of near misses on sidewalks and things like that. And I think if you just use basic logic, when you put people on scooters without helmets in the middle of traffic with cars, I mean, it just doesn't seem like a great idea. It seems like they need to at least try and figure out some standards, although, of course, they're still going to be on streets with cars.
And there have been plenty of stories. I did one here in Charlotte, but in other cities as well, about the rising number of injuries from these. I mean, you go to talk to ER docs, and they tell you that, you know, this is definitely an increase, and it's definitely due to scooters.
And when you put scooters on a street where there is no bike lane and people open their car doors as you're zipping down the street at 15 miles an hour, that's a recipe for problems. Mayor Pro Tem Julie Eisenhower says that Charlotte is helping chart new ground nationally with our regulations. How so?
I think that was a reference just to the fact that they are establishing
just having
rules.
The regulations is charting new ground. I mean, as I say, the cities are all talking to each other. Several people said during the meeting this week that they expect these will be revisited.
And also, Charlotte City Council really is embracing the scooters. These regulations are not that they're not that bad for the companies. The companies aren't angry that Charlotte City Council passed these. So I think Charlotte City Council really wants to show other cities that you can embrace these things and they will be beneficial.
And as you just said, David, not everybody on council is in favor of this. Braxton Winston has never been in favor of these regulations, and he's had reservations on Monday night, warning that they could soon be outdated as technology of scooters improves.
Let's say that it is a product that can go 25 miles per hour and be safer in a street right of way. And we're going to have to go back and redo the ordinance because we have regulated it out of legality.
Likely to happen?
They will definitely be back looking at this as things evolve.
I thought Ed Driggs made a good point, which he said this whole thing is arbitrary, referring to, you know, there is a,
aren't all rules.
Well, yeah, but particularly in this case, because there in many instances there's just a lack of data available. I mean, you know how many people are riding, but we don't really have. I didn't see many statistics presented in terms of injuries, all those kinds of things.
That's why I keep asking.
Yeah,
because I read the paper every day. I listen to us every day. I watch watch TV news, I haven't seen a lot of stories about people dying, being majorly injured, about automobile drivers complaining about. I hear more complaints about bicycles.
Well, one thing about that, though, is that, you know, we don't cover traffic accidents, at least not at my...
Panel 9
I
does.
I do. I will say, Panel 9 representative here.
I did cover one scooter accident.
If the lights are flashing blue, they're there.
As someone who's spent a lot of time near flashing blue lights for traffic accidents, I will say I've covered at least one incident involving a scooter, but it was minor injuries. That person ended up being okay. And I do know that we did cover last year at least one fatality, but that was not on a scooter. That was on one of the bikes.
So Luana Mayfield, Braxton Winston, and Matt Newton opposed this. What were Mayfield and Newton's objections?
Well, I think in the case, I mentioned Luana Mayfield earlier, she has been concerned that the city staff is presenting all of this in a what she calls a pro-scooter perspective. So she thinks there is a lack of context of the downside to various aspects of these scooters. Braxton Winston, as you mentioned, is very much in favor of scooters. He just doesn't think that the regulations work. David, Joe, anybody know what Matt Newton's? I can't remember him
commenting on it.
Yeah, I don't remember him saying much. So,
Very quickly, when do these regulations go into effect, and what entity enforces them? Police?
The new 500-man scooter squad. No, I'm kidding.
I think they're in effect immediately.
Yes.
And, you know, it'll be up to police to enforce them. There was some discussion about whether you could use the apps that these things are controlled by to figure out if somebody went off the sidewalk in the wrong area or whether they were exceeding the speed limit somehow. And that technology is either not here yet.
Oh, you can do that with a cell phone. You can check their cell phone account.
It's true. But, you know, that is a Big Brother level of regulation of these that nobody seems willing to go to.
Okay. I'm going to make a note that talking about scooters is more fun than talking about HB2.
Put a quarter in the bucket.
In November, voters said yes to $50 million in bonds to increase the supply of affordable housing in the city, and the city quickly received proposals for 620 affordable housing units that would eat up the entire $50 million, along with some other projects already in the pipeline. So is it a foregone conclusion that most of the proposed projects that we eat up that money will be approved and funded before
No.
we talk about additional funding? No.
No. So the city has committed to $9.5 million so far. And you're right. They did hear that the request would exceed the $50 million in bonds, which, of course, was a tripling of what is traditionally done. But the whole premise of this new approach to affordable housing is to not only match the $50 million of public money with $50 million of private money, but it's to spend it in new ways and try to leverage it to get more out of it than they traditionally have. So, for example, the $50 million of private money is expected to generate around 2,100 affordable housing units. And at the upcoming city council retreat, they're going to talk about how far they think they can make the money go, spending it in different ways than they have traditionally.
So I think the discussion the other night was Pamela Weidman, the city housing director, was walking the council through, here's what we have in the pipeline right now. It's already going to exceed the $50 million. I think that was part of her argument for why she really wants to work on a partnership with the private sector here. And the answers to questions about how that would work were very slim the other night.
Well, the private sector stepped forward the very next day. Shortly after the Monday night discussion, three major financial institutions pledged $70 million more. Was that anticipated? I know it's been asked for.
We've been waiting for that.
They knew it was coming?
They had been waiting to make that announcement. They thought it was going to be made at the end of last year. And they already had $10 million committed earlier in 2018. So the mayor... basically demanded that the private sector match the $50 million to support putting this on the ballot. So that's where that piece is coming from. The private sector is trying to raise $50 million in essentially grant money, and they have $21 million of that. The other money is coming for a different aspect.
We'll talk some more about where this $70 million is coming from and how it's going to be allocated. That was Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal. Joe Bruno is here from WSSC-TV. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call. David Borax from WFAE News. And we will continue our conversation about affordable housing, about the early budgeting trial balloon at Mecklenburg County, about ICE arrests at the courthouse, and more on Charlotte Talks. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. It's the local news roundup. I'm Mike Collins with Mary C. Curtis, Joe Bruno, Eric Spanberg, and David Borax, all gathered around our little table here at Spirit Square. So the $70 million came forward from three major financial institutions on Tuesday. I believe they made this a public announcement. Bank of America, Ally Financial, and Barings. They pledged a combined $70.75 million through a series of initiatives. How are they breaking this down?
Well, the biggest piece is 50.
This is for affordable housing.
Affordable housing. The biggest piece is $50 million that will go toward lower.
Excuse me, there's a scooter on the side.
Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody make an arrest. where was I? Oh, the $50 million of lower interest loans to help build affordable housing so that you can bring the rent prices down, obviously. So that's $50 million over 15 years. And as I mentioned earlier, $11 million of the total is going toward what they call the grant debt equity, which is the fund that will match the $50 million of public money. So they're about halfway to their $50 million goal, but they have these other pots of money, Mike, that they're using to try and lower interest rates and help with other agencies.
Will this encourage other businesses and financial and/or financial institutions to
step That is forward? The hope here. Yeah. I mean, this is like a capital campaign by a nonprofit institution. You know, they had Wells Fargo make the early announcement, and then Bank of America and others come in right now. There's one other piece in here which I find really interesting. There's $7 million of land being donated uptown by Bank of America. One of them is right here outside of our studio. The other one is a little bit farther up North Tryon Street. There really isn't any affordable housing uptown right now, and there is an effort in this to try and make sure that that happens. You know, why shouldn't the people who serve your coffee or your sandwich every day have a place to live uptown in addition to all the other workers that live here?
And one thing to mention, Mike, I'm sorry, just to interrupt real quick, Mary, they're also bringing in a national nonprofit to kind of manage this process, go through the strategy, and things like land donation are a new part of the approach that the city is taking.
No, I was just going to say that a big challenge is that the need is so great. So all of this is needed, and they need the public-private partnership. But even the few units they're going to do will not really – we need, what, 24,000 units of affordable housing. And then there's also the debates of where can these things be built. They don't want low-income housing to be concentrated in certain areas, so you'll have pockets of poverty. And they've loosened that regulation somewhat. So that's another debate. And also the folks who are eligible, what is considered low income, folks making 50% of the median income. We have a great need for folks who are making 30% and less and are using an incredible amount of their income for housing. So it's a very complicated proposition, and they really, you know, no matter what they are going to do, there's going to be that great a need.
David.
Mary, you talked about location of these things, and another thing the council approved this week was a change in their policy on that. In the past, they have tried to steer it all over the city and keep it from being concentrated in certain areas. But one of the things they've discovered is that some of the areas that were previously off limits actually need affordable housing now. I did a story this week about the West End neighborhood, Seversville, Smallwood, Biddleville area, and those have changed dramatically over the last 10 years to the point now where you can't get a house for under $400,000 there, and there's very little low-income apartments there. So that's an area where this is actually needed, which previously was off-limits.
Oh, yeah, these close-in neighborhoods like Cherry, who would become gentrified, and the folks who grew up there can't stay there.
We'll be focusing on Cherry on Monday.
So Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan has said these institutions in the city working together is a great model for other cities addressing similar issues. Is Bank of America involved in this kind of an effort in other cities? Do we know?
I think that they're trying to get involved in other cities. It's interesting. Charlotte obviously had a pretty good week with these announcements, but then Microsoft kind of blew things out of the water with a $500 million donation over 3 years in Seattle. So this is something, and Brian Moynihan said this, is going on in cities all across the country.
Is it cheaper for these companies to kick in this kind of money to build affordable housing than it is to raise incomes so people can afford the housing that's already there? I mean, that sounds like
a cosmic question.
That's a question, but seriously, we know about wage stagnation. and their people are being priced out because their wages haven't risen. Is it cheaper to just kick in some money to build affordable housing than it is to raise
I'm not sure that's salaries. Really what's at issue here. I mean, I think Bank of America was one of the first companies to raise everybody to $15 that wasn't already there. And, I think the banks are in other cities doing the same things. I mean, Wells Fargo has made announcements mm-hmm. all over the country as well.
So. Mike, let me go back just for a second. There are three numbers I want to mention real quick. Last 30 years, home values up 36%,
right.
rental rates up 24%,
yep.
average median income up 4%.
Yep.
So that's the problem. That's what you're getting at mm-hmm. right there. That's in Charlotte. Those numbers are for Charlotte.
So Barings chairman and chief executive Tom Finke said that this is just a first step. He said that while this investment is significant, there is more work to be done to make affordable housing achievable and sustainable in Charlotte. Why are these businesses interested at all in this? Why do they care?
Well, I think there are a number of things. I mean, peer pressure is important. You mentioned, are they trying to get the other companies to do this? Michael Marzicano from the Foundation for the Carolinas is spearheading this. He's pretty influential. But also, they recognize that this is unsustainable. Think of all the problems that come with not being able to give people secure housing, because it's not just people who literally don't have housing. It's also people who are under so much financial pressure, that is, they're spending much more than 30% of their monthly income on housing. And so then other things fall apart, healthcare, nutrition, all those things, and it leads to all these other societal problems.
And you can be sure they're looking at other big cities that are having these problems in crisis mode. You go to cities like San Francisco, where people who are working are homeless.
Right.
And they see, as we grow, they want to keep us, as you say, Eric, to have a healthy city.
Back to your point, Mike, about incomes are really an issue here. I think, Eric, you mentioned LISC, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, the nonprofit that's been brought into Charlotte to try and help out with this effort. And they're actually bringing another $25 million in at the same time here. And this week we got a little more clarity on what they're going to spend that on. Some of that may go for housing, but some of it is also going to programs that are designed to increase economic mobility. And so they want to try and work on that issue as well.
So this injection of money from the business community, the $70 million that came in, is the second leg of a three-legged stool. The first leg was the $50 million bond issue for affordable housing. The third leg is the money that the mayor has asked the faith community to come forward with, and that's another $50 million. Do we know if any progress has been made on that front?
You know, Hugh McCall mentioned at the event on Bank of America CEO Hugh McCall mentioned at the event the other day something that his church is doing for 200 units, I think, of affordable housing. We don't have any hard numbers on that. I think one thing that will be interesting to watch, Mike, we were talking earlier about donating land. One of the things that is being closely looked at is the fact that churches own a lot of land in Charlotte, and that is tax-free land. And so I think there is a forthcoming push to see how much land might be donated by churches.
So, Joe, you covered the trial balloon at the Mecklenburg County Commission. They did something for the first time. They decided to hold a public hearing about the budget before the county manager does the budget. How novel. To find out what people thought were the priorities for the people. And it turns out that one of the priorities is parks.
Yeah, a lot of people want parks. Parks was definitely a dominating topic. One of the groups that spoke was the Parks Commission, and they were asking for the 2008 bond-approved parks to finally, get the construction rolling on those, more than a decade later here. They said that there were at least six projects that need additional funding so they can kickstart the work there.
And there was an article in the paper about this morning, and it talked about how the parks have never recovered from the recession where they laid off an enormous number of people and cut the budget a lot. The budget pretty much has recovered. Staffing is up, but not to the levels that it was prior to the Great Recession, and we have recovered from the Great Recession. Bank of America just had its highest profits ever.
Well, and remember, I think everyone around this table will remember is that the Trust for Public Lands has put Charlotte at or near the bottom for the past 5 years in terms of access to parks. And all of this happens with the backdrop of not only what you covered, Joe, but then you had the Monday night meeting where the Cross Charlotte Trail, which would fall into the category of Parks and Rec, is about $77 million in the hole for a project that was supposed to cost $38 million. Oops.
So what other priorities emerged from that meeting?
The other, the dueling topic was education with parks, and a lot of teachers came and spoke and asked for Mecklenburg County commissioners to really make education their issue, to be bold on the issue, boost a teacher supplement, and make Mecklenburg County the county where teachers in North Carolina went to work.
Okay. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents arrested two individuals this week at Mecklenburg County Courthouse on Wednesday. It marks the second time this year that ICE agents have made arrests there. Is this happening because our new sheriff, Gary McFadden, has ended the 287G program? And the response to that was an ICE guy in Atlanta saying, well, we're going to have to crack down in Charlotte then. Is this what's happening?
There was no direct comment on this latest couple of arrests here, but we have to assume that they're looking to make these arrests in any way that they can. They have made arrests at the courthouse before, and it's always a big deal when you have people coming in literally at the entrance to the courtroom and putting people in handcuffs.
They're there obeying the law because they've been asked to appear, right?
That's right.
And ICE knows that they've been asked to appear, so they nab them? Is that how it works?
That's right, and apparently there was a struggle this time as well. So,
Before I come to you, Mary, it was the struggle precipitated by the fact that the two ICE agents making the arrest allegedly were dressed in a sweatshirt and a hoodie with no badge, no identification, and they didn't identify
themselves. Other officials in the courtroom asked, who are you guys?
Yeah, I mean,
the guy resisted. He wasn't sure what was going on.
Well, yeah, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Okay, Mary.
Well, no, I'm just saying that ICE agents traditionally, even though they can, they basically say that they don't go to courthouses, churches, schools, or
clearly
hospitals.
Clearly they do.
No, but that's sort of because, of course, folks bring their kids to schools, churches,
right.
And of course with the courthouses, the police are saying, listen, people will be afraid to report a crime, to be a witness, to show up in court, and that will ultimately make things less safe in a community. So that's the argument.
Joe. Going back to what you said, Mike, 287G, when that program was eliminated, ICE came out and said, listen, since we don't have this tool anymore, we are going to go out into your community, and we can't promise that we won't find other people who we might be looking
for. Well, maybe somebody on this table can explain this to me, because when I had Gary McFadden on talking about the end of 287G and why he ended it, he made it sound as though really nothing has changed. ICE can still figure out who's in the jail and what their immigration status is. They're just not reporting it directly to ICE. The information is still there and still available. So really, what has changed? A phone call? We got a guy? Come get him?
I think that's what's changed. I mean, I heard that program, and he said they can still come in here and get people if they want. But it's not as easy as having it kind of handed to you on a tray.
Okay. Over the holidays, Sheriff McFadden also temporarily reinstituted in-person visitation to the jail. His predecessor had limited those visits to video-only visits. Now these in-person visits have been permanently restored. When did that start?
I think just this past week, and now inmates at the jail can get an in-person visit once a week, and they can do a video call once a week for free. And that was one of the pledges he made when he was running, and it was pretty basic, and I think people, that was one of the reasons why people voted for him.
The argument is that prisoners tend to get in less trouble, be more motivated for good behavior if they can have in-person visits.
Basically connects them to society.
Right.
And he's had several of these promises that he's kept, not putting teens in solitary confinement, 287G, and this one, the video calls. And as you say, David, I think this was a part of the platform.
Yeah, everything the sheriff said he was going to do, he has done to this point. But I remember talking to the old sheriff, Sheriff Carmichael, about this proposal to bring back in-person visits. And I think this is what astonished him the most, was that this would be on the table, because he was concerned about his deputy's safety.
Yeah. Construction. I moved here in 1985. Construction on the I-77 toll lanes has been going on I-77 through Charlotte. It's been going on since then, I got to tell you. But I-77 toll lane construction has been going on for quite a while now. And recently people have begun to complain about how dangerous the stretch of the interstate has become. How many accidents, near accidents, or other problems have been caused by toll lane construction? Does anybody know?
There was a statistic included in a safety report that I did a story on this week that said that the crashes shot up 88% since the construction started. That needs a little vetting, but it does seem like
Whose statistic was that?
That was from a activist, a tolling opponent. Yeah.
But I was making light of the fact that that highway has been under construction since the beginning of time. But all highways are constantly under construction everywhere in the country. If they don't have them under construction, then they're going to crumble and fall away. So why is this project any more dangerous than any other highway?
You know, these complaints started the day the construction started three years ago.
The reason for the construction is unpopular?
Yes. That is absolutely
I think that's a big factor.
But, you know, there is something here. I mean, there's been some egregious examples of metal chunks in the road flying up and breaking windshields and people running into the barriers. And, you know, part of the issue also is we're still driving too fast in the middle of a construction project, but that's another issue.
But even, I think, if you look at it anecdotally to an extent, anyone who's driven that stretch, it's a little dicey, and it is difficult at night. I saw the report that you did, Joe, talking about how treacherous it can be at night, and I agree with that.
Yeah, there have been examples where they've not repainted the lanes in a timely manner, so you really don't know where you are. They call them ghost lanes. And there was one big example of 77 North onto 85 where for about a week you really couldn't tell which lane you were supposed to be in.
It's still like that. I drove up to Mooresville, exit 36, and there are lanes all over the place. The old lanes are still there. There are remnants of the past lanes still there. You don't know where you're supposed to
drive. Is that unusual? When they're going to shift the lane patterns, do they black out the old lanes and put in new lane markers? Is this unusual that they haven't done that here? And if so, why haven't they done it?
That's a good question. Typically, I feel like they pave over the old lanes and it just looks like normal pavement. But here they kind of, they tore it up and you could still see some of the lines.
So you reported on Michelle Furlotto, founder of the Lake Norman Transportation Safety Partnership, complaining about this to the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Is this a new interest group?
She has been around for a while. She's been a vocal toll opponent. She was the one who actually discovered all of the chunks of metal that were being uprooted on the highway and flying into people's vehicles. So she has made some pretty bombshell discoveries before. But she basically compiled all of these issues, like, you know, there's no lights on the interstate to every time it rains, the interstate floods. And she composed an email to NCDOT, sent it to James Trogdon, the NCDOT secretary.
Before this group was formed, they actually filed some complaints, and they got a response from the DOT, which was an investigation and some pledges of some fixes for that, and here we are again.
Right. Well, and some of this, Mike, predates predates the toll lanes. Remember when Pat McCrory was mayor? I know you do. He complained about the lack of lights on that interstate for, I think, all 14 years he was mayor, and nothing ever happened.
Well, we should be. North Carolina needs to be embarrassed by the state of its roads when you compare it to South Carolina and Virginia. We just need to be embarrassed because if you cross the state line in either direction, the roads are incredibly better. Yeah. And it's been this way in North Carolina since the beginning of the automobile. No, seriously, because
you remember?
No, but I know that the longtime morning guy at WBT was on a campaign for roads, as was one of the governors back in the 1930s. And we're still having the same problems. When we come back, coal ash rears its ugly head. And we'll get an update on another of our favorite topics, the 9th Congressional District. Buckle up. It's going to be a bumpy ride, highways or not. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Joe Bruno reports for Channel 9 Eyewitness News. And Mary C. Curtis is here from Roll Call and WCCB-TV. Last night in Catawba County, there was supposed to be a little gathering where state officials and others were going to lay out tables. And on those tables were charts and information about coal ash at Duke Power Plants around the area. And people were going to come in and they'd be able to go to these tables and read the information and ask questions. And you were there, David, and you were about to leave when all hell broke loose.
So this was a good idea. And they did this in Greensboro a couple of weeks ago. And 150 people came and they walked around and got information, asked questions of the DEQ officials that were there. There were so many people at this meeting last night. There were at least 500 in the gym, and I was told that more people were outside and were not allowed in because of the capacity of the room. And they basically demanded that that there be statements at the microphone and that they get a chance to speak. It was not billed as a public hearing. There's one that's coming later for that. But what ended up happening was they, first of all, they did a little show of hands in the room about which one of the proposals for closing these coal ash pits at the Marshall Steam Station did people support. And everybody in the room, with exception of one guy that I saw, raised their hands when they said, dig this stuff up and move it somewhere else. Yeah. One person raised his hand when they said, what about if we did partly that way and partly leave it where it is with new covers over it? And nobody was in favor of the idea that Duke supports, which is to leave it where it is and just put new waterproof covers over the top of it. And so that was the first chance for people to give their opinions about it. And then they, for about an hour, they went back and forth with microphones, talking, people making statements and asking pointed questions about why they have to do it this other way. And it got off on a little bit of a tangent. Some people may be familiar that there's been some cases of thyroid cancer in southern Iredell County. And although there is no officially supported idea that there's a link between the two of these, many people there are concerned about that, and they were asking questions about it. So basically, folks hijacked this quiet meeting and turned it into a public hearing.
Well, to the credit of people from the Department of Environmental Quality, they didn't fight it. They went ahead and held a meeting, essentially, and took the heat and took questions.
They did, and there were some couple of state legislators there who it could have gone the wrong way for them, but right. Once the topic got onto the thyroid cancer scare, they spent a lot of time explaining that as well, and they did invite people to talk to them. I mean, one of the issues here is that the law could be changed. It could be required under the law that Duke dig all of these things up, but that's not what the law says right now, and it's not clear if there's support in the
legislature. Well, we've been talking about this for years, and one of the key that emerged from this is that most people want this coal ash removed, and we've talked about this and how if you start doing that, it's a continuous stream of dump trucks for 30 years, every day, 24/7. Is that what they want?
People are saying that they would like to have that. They'd rather have that than have that stuff stay where it is. And Duke also says it's going to cost $1 billion. You know, there's a lot of work here. And this, we're just talking right now about the one plant that was at issue last night, the Marshall plant on Lake Norman. Yeah.
But, of course, it's all over the state.
Are they afraid that this will set a precedent that they have to do it that way
well,
here?
Well, so Duke has 14 current and former coal plants around the state. Eight of them are already required to be dug up, and that's by legislation or court orders. Six of the other six plants are what's being decided right now, and Duke would like to leave it where it is at those plants. In some cases, it's going to be recycled on site. But anyway, the decision will be made in April about what happens with those other six.
So there is still no resolution in the struggle over who will represent the 9th Congressional District in Congress.
Breaking. Yeah. Right.
A Superior Court judge has set a hearing for January 22nd in a lawsuit filed by the Republican candidate Mark Harris, who leads Democrat Dan McCready by about 905 votes. Harris is asking the State Board of Elections to certify the results and declare him the winner. Is he being supported in that effort by the state Republican Party?
Today he is.
Okay.
Yes. I mean,
well, you bring up an interesting point because prior to the holidays, Dallas Woodhouse, who is the executive director of the state Republican Party, held a press conference in which he spoke for the party and for its chairman, Robin Hayes, saying that irregularities needed to be investigated and new elections, including a primary, needed to be held. Now, Robin Hayes, the chairman of the party, says there is no evidence that any irregularities would have changed the outcome, and the state GOP is now accusing former Democratic chairman of the Board of Elections of potential collusion, we've talked about this before, of a Democrat in Bladen County. Why this change in direction on the part of the Republican Party, who seem to be bending over backwards and stumbling all over themselves to have a new election?
Well, one thing that happened, and I'm going to turn this over to Joe very quickly because he is much more of an expert on this than I am, but one thing that happened was, as you remember, in December, Mark Harris said at one point that he was not getting support from the Republican Party the way that Dan McCready was from the Democrats. And
he's getting support from the Democratic Party?
No.
Really?
Dan McCready
is getting support? I've heard nothing from the Democratic Party.
I have a feeling some of those lawyers that he's got working for him have pretty close ties to the Democratic Party. But from that moment on, the tenor really changed when it came to Dallas Woodhouse and Robin Hayes.
Three things at play here. Harris at first was pretty silent on the issue. He wasn't allowed to talk. He wasn't allowed to defend himself while he was getting an attorney and preparing for this. Another thing is Dallas has said if there was evidence of wrongdoing or evidence of, an outcome changing thing here, it would have come out by now. which people would argue, you know, the state board is still investigating. We should let this play out. But that is one of his claims here. The other thing is he got a lot of heat from Republicans. This whole ordeal has torn apart the Republican Party with people who are very pro-Harris and people who think that the investigation should play out. But a lot of the pro-Harris supporters have been attacking the party leadership.
So, not to bring in technicalities here, but there actually isn't an election board right now that could actually decide this election.
That's a small problem, David.
I was going to ask about that because this week the North Carolina Board of Elections, which doesn't exist, said in a court filing this week that it can't declare Mark Harris the winner over Dan McCready until a new board is seated. So who is speaking for the non-existent board?
The staff. The staff is speaking for them. There's a board. They're just earning members.
The staff is still doing the investigation.
I want to race through this. So because we've talked about this ad nauseum. So could the courts make a decision before the board is constituted?
That's what Harris is hoping for. He's hoping that since all of the local counties have certified the race and no protests were filed, that the court will order the executive director.
But Democrats in the House of Representatives have said they will not seat anybody until the election is certified. Would that be considered a certification for the court to say you won?
When I asked Harris's attorney about that, he said, we'll deal with the House of Representatives when we get there.
Also, Dan McCready, who hadn't been saying much, is talking a lot right now and saying basically, no, the fact that there's a taint on the election is a problem. And also, we don't know how many absentee ballots might have been thrown out. So this whole argument that it wouldn't have changed the outcome doesn't hold water.
And the top Democrat in the House Administration Committee, California Democrat Zoe Lofgren, has is monitoring this investigation and has told State Elections Board to preserve and protect all of their documentation on their investigation. So is it likely that this House committee will do its own investigation
no matter what
the court says?
The problem, or I guess the situation we have here, Mike, is that we have three different tracks. We have the legal track, we have the reconstituted board whenever they come around, and then we have what Congress is going to do. So get a big jar so that we can put money in here.
That does not include any tracks yet to be decided.
So the government shutdown continues, and now local news outlets around the country are reporting on the impact outside of the D.C. area. Here in this region, about 17,000 people are affected and not getting a paycheck. Spectrum News spoke with a woman named Rachel Brummert. She is one of those people, an FDA employee living in Charlotte.
We don't know where the food is going to come from. We don't know where the mortgage is going to come from. You know, my husband now donates plasma so that he can make money off of that.
Wow. Evidently, 4,700 federal workers locally filed for unemployment. And when you file for unemployment, this happened in the last week of December, you're required to look for work. So have hiring managers around the city been seeing an uptick in people coming to them asking for a job?
I think I saw mentioned somewhere that temp agencies were hearing a lot more from federal workers. So I think the obvious answer is yes. I couldn't give you numbers on that, but clearly people are hurting and they've got to find something to do.
So, and collecting unemployment is it's actually, there's lots of technicalities there. And I read something this morning that said that one of the problems is that the unemployment folks will call your boss and find out if you are, in fact, not on the job. The problem is the bosses are furloughed, too, so they can't get information there.
So this is day 28 of the shutdown, and people are complaining about trying to make decisions about paying their cars and paying their mortgages, paying for their medicine, daycare, et cetera, although I'm sure the need for daycare is limited because you're home. But when does the real pain begin, Mary, for most of these people, when they start being threatened by their mortgage company or their car loan company?
Well, we've seen some companies step up and give a little aid to it. But yeah, you can't just pay for childcare and these things with a promise.
And I keep seeing stories on network news from local news about how it's affecting communities around the country. How has Charlotte been impacted, the actual city of Charlotte, at all? Do we know?
Well, we see in all of these cities that it's not just the people who are out of work, but the ancillary businesses, the restaurants that serve them, all of these other businesses, the people that do their hair and these things. So all of these businesses it's a trickle-down effect. And I think the shutdown has shown people what government does and the fact that it's not just concentrated in Washington, but it's all around the country.
So is it ironic in any way I already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway to make a point.
That's a good lawyer. He already knows the answer.
Is it ironic in any way that this is all going on because of the president's desire for $5 billion for a wall that Mexico was going to pay for, and the Democratic House refusing to even consider giving any money to the president for this wall unless he opens the government? Meanwhile, one of the results of the shutdown is that Charlotte's immigration court
yes.
is shut down, and they already had a 14-month backlog of cases. Any irony there? I'm just checking.
Okay. I think the answer he wants is yes.
So and not just the immigration court here, but on the border.
And in immigration courts around the country, in fact. So let's go back 10 years ago this Tuesday, January 15th, 2009.
1539, hit birds, so you've lost thrust on both engines, returning back towards LaGuardia.
Cactus 1529, we can get it for you. Do you want to try to land 1013?
We're unable. We may end up in the Hudson.
Both Captain Sully Sullenberger and the air traffic controller got the flight number wrong. So serious was this moment, especially when Sully told everyone listening that the plane was going to land on the Hudson River. Chilling words, even to professionals like air traffic controller Patrick Harton. I know that because he told me. He and almost all of the 155 passengers and crew of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 and many first responders, the former governor of New York, David Patterson, and family members were here in Charlotte this week to celebrate 10 years of life since that day. They were celebrating here because, as you all recall, the plane's final destination was Charlotte, and many, I think almost half of the passengers, were from Charlotte. They didn't make it here that day because the flight encountered a flock of birds on takeoff, knocking out both of the engines. And I had the pleasure of hosting a panel discussion this week at the Convention Center with Captain Sullenberger, the First Officer Jeff Skiles, three of the flight attendants, passengers, and others, who then headed over to the Aviation Museum, where that airplane is kept, to have a toast, a toast to life, at 3:31 p.m., the exact moment when the plane hit the water. That moment, I didn't know this until this event. Governor Patterson got up to speak, and it was he who dubbed it the miracle on the Hudson. But everybody in aviation, including Sully, says that is an incorrect way to describe the moment because pilots don't talk that way. They call it a mission completed. And Sully told the crowd gathered there that he didn't deserve all the credit.
We were standing on the shoulders of everybody else who's done this. And there are hundreds of thousands of people who over 4 or 5 decades have made this system in which we operate so resilient, so robust, that we were able to do these things. And so there are a lot of people out there who have that same dedication, who feel that same obligation that we felt to do whatever it takes to save every life.
At every opportunity that afternoon, he deflected credit to others. And they had a lot of great stories to tell about what has happened as a result of being able to live these extra 10 years. The airplane is in the museum, but the museum has to move by the summer.
That's right. They've known for a few years that they were going to get kicked out of the it's an old Wachovia corporate jet hangar at the airport, and they moved there when they got the plane because they needed a bigger space. But the FAA has guidelines that say, you know, if there's corporate hangar space at the airport, it has to be available for basically companies that are operating aircraft. And the museum has aircraft, but they're not flying regularly. So they've been talking behind the scenes here for a while now about relocating the museum. Last year, they came out with a new facilities plan that envisions this international quality aviation museum here in Charlotte. It's going to be another place. You know, people are hoping it'll be on the airport site. Maybe it'll be near it. They're going to have to raise tens of millions of dollars. I talked to Stephen Saucier this week, who's the president of the museum, and there's a big campaign to come.
Okay. Well, talking about this, I'm sure, in the very near future, because that plane is a major exhibit for the country, not just for us. Carolina Panthers owner David Tepper talked to reporters this week about plans in the works about the two Carolinas aspect of the team. What did we learn from Mr. Tepper?
We learned that he definitely is interested in a new team practice and training headquarters. He didn't give us a lot of clues as to where that's going to be. Said they're continuing work. He did make it pretty clear that they will not be continuing training camp in Spartanburg after this year. And the other thing that I don't know if we learned it, but we confirmed it, is nobody's really sure what's going on with Cam Newton's shoulder. So
he said that he would be happy to let Cam sit out the entire season if he thought
he could come back well the
right.
season after.
Right.
The Colts did that with Andrew Luck, and he came back and put him in the playoffs.
And then he said several times, I'm not a doctor, so it was kind of like a Holiday Inn Express commercial. But
and he talked about finding a new quarterback. Do we need to find a new quarterback? The two backups seem to be pretty good in those last games.
Yeah, there's a difference between spot duty and the full season.
And he needs to have a line to protect the quarterback.
He also talked about continuing discussions with Major League Soccer about bringing an expansion club to Charlotte that he and the Panthers would own and which would share the stadium. Is this new news? Did we know this
before? He had been talking about it, but he confirmed that they're very serious about it. I would expect it to happen, and I know you're out of time.
I am out of time. You can hear the band. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Joe Bruno from Channel 9, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, David Borax from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.